Case number 20-1671, Helena Agra Enterprises, LLC versus Great Lakes Grain, LLC, et al. Argument not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. Zurich, you may proceed for the appellant.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court. Zach Zurich for appellant Helena Agra Enterprises, LLC. I've reserved 3 minutes for rebuttal. The record raises a fact question regarding first-time farmers Nicholas and Stacy Borson fraudulently utilized actual production history of the legacy Borson entities to obtain millions of dollars in financing and thousands of acres of cropland, and are therefore acting as the successors to Helena's $15 million legacy Borson judgment debtors, principally controlled by the appellee's husband and father, Dennis Borson. The district court erred, one, by granting appellee's motion for summary judgment, and two, denying three different timely file discovery motions made by Helena in this case. First, as to the motion for
counsel on this production history point, I do appreciate that it's really significant in this area, right? I can imagine it making a big difference on the insurance and so forth, but it seems like a very funny, you know, property interest. I mean, you know, does one think of one's track record as a driver, you know, lack of car accidents as a property interest? I wouldn't think of it as a property interest. And it's true, it may factor into the insurance you get, but again, I don't think of it as a transferable property interest. And you seem to be treating it as a transferable property interest. And that's odd to me. Do you have any cases that say you can think of it as a transferable property interest? It just seems like a fact. It seems like a fact. It's a set of facts, and you don't usually own facts.
Your Honor, while there isn't a specific case it's talking about within a veil piercing or fraudulent transfer theory, characterizing actual production history as a specific property interest, as it is defined by the Voidable Transfer Act, it is very significant. The importance of crop insurance and actual production history is shown by the various criminal cases cited in the appellant's brief.
Well, just to pause, that just reminds me of my own driving record. It's very relevant. It can make a dollars and cents difference. And I could commit fraud if I lied about it. So I get it that it could be the premise of a fraud claim. I don't understand how it's a transferable property interest. And if it's not a transferable property interest, how does the statute or anything else apply to it?
Your Honor, the difference between a driving record and actual production history is that actual production history is the key to unlocking financing for any farming operation. Because specifically in this instance, appellees were leasing their land. And so when they go to a lender, the lender is taking collateral in the crop. And so for a lender to understand how much collateral they're going to have in the crop, they look at the actual production history and the crop insurance protecting the specific collateral.
How about this? Can I, if you had some land which was very productive, I wanted to buy it, and I'm saying, you know, the price is a little expensive. Is there any chance I could not purchase the production history?
So
that's a joke. No one would think that's real. You can't do that. I can't say, give me a $100,000 discount because I don't want anything to do with the production history. That's just, it's nonsense, isn't it?
No, I disagree, Your Honor, because in this situation, the Risk Management Association, the USDA, sets forth two particular elements that must be shown in order for there to be a transfer, which it specifically references as the action that's occurring between the transferor and the transferee, and it's twofold. One, participation and management between the successor and the predecessor, and then two, participation in the physical production of the crops. And so there's very strict standards that go into the transfer of this actual production history. And
let me ask you just the mechanics of it, because I'm not clear as to how is the production history created and then how is it transferred, just factually?
Yes, Your Honor. So the production history is created over years of farming. And that's part of the reason that the proportionality of Helena's discovery request was met here, because if you look into the record at the actual production history reports, which are included in the evidence in the motion for summary judgment, you'll see that there is reports where somebody physically takes data on a tractor and accounts for the actual yield or bushels that are produced in a given crop year.
And so this is computer generated data from a tractor?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And is it based on just what crop runs through the tractor, or is it based on like GPS data, or do you know?
The specific technological aspects of it, I'm not entirely clear on, Your Honor, but I know that it's a specific metric that's reported to the crop insurance companies to determine whether there was a loss in a particular year. And it's verifiable data, and typically there is a specific individual who certifies the yield that's reported for this actual production history.
Does the data go in real time to the who does the data go to when it goes on the computer? Is this part of the equipment itself, or is it being transmitted to the crop insurer somehow through this mechanism?
Yes, Your Honor. So it's actually taken, once this data is calculated, it's taken and it's reported to both the Risk Management Association and the approved insurance provider in order to make a determination of the actual production history data and then the rates for the crop insurance and the amount of yield protection that the crop insurance will have.
And I take it there's no non-disclosure agreement accompanying the transmission of the data to the these various entities.
No, Your Honor. Well, it is still private protected data because specifically in this instance, we had to obtain written authorizations from the appellees to obtain the documents that were relevant to the actual production history. And when we looked to the discovery motions by Helena, that was a big portion of what took up the time once the appellees finally appeared into the case. And so Helena obtained through Freedom of Information Act requests and finally authorizations provided by the appellees, and they were able to get this data. And then with respect to the motion for—
So you could get the data through a FOIA request?
Yes, Your Honor, but then in terms—
Okay, so why isn't that make it public domain? I mean, how does it become private property if you can get it through a FOIA request?
Your Honor, I think the accessibility of the information and the utilization and property interest of the information is not necessarily in it being proprietary or confidential. It's what it allows the farmer or transferee to do with it. And so in this instance, because the appellees had actual production history from a mega farming enterprise such as the Borsons, who at one point were farming over 100,000 acres, they were able to, in turn, start a farming operation that was more than 19 times the USDA's 2019 average farm size. In a report from the USDA, the average farm size was 444 acres. Because of the transfer of this actual production history, the appellees were able to each open farms that were over 8,000 acres.
Why are those, under your three theories of this case, number one, why are those new entities successors? It requires common ownership. Our cases have repeatedly said that's a prerequisite to successor liability, common ownership. Here, the two new owners are not owners of the old companies.
Yes, Your Honor, at least on paper, but there are three fact issues that were created by the evidence in the record as to continuity. One, the appellees are using the same land, assets, and personnel as the legacy Borson entities. Two, meeting notes show that the legacy Borson entities...
Common ownership is an absolute requirement, I think. Do these factors go to common ownership, or is there case law to suggest that you can actually, even though the paper owner is clearly different from the old owner, that you can actually look through the paper owner to see who is actually the true owner or the pragmatic owner or the practical owner? Is there any Michigan case law for that proposition?
Your Honor, in terms of successor liability, it has turned on the point of who is the actual person in charge here. And I think that when we also look at the Voidable Transfer Act claim, that's also a very big point that's at play here, specifically turning to the badges of fraud that are an element
With that, I mean, doesn't it require that the debtor transfer something? What debtor has transferred anything here? When the equipment transfers come from a non-debtor entity, and the only land transfer that I think you're challenging comes from Ceres, which is not a debtor. So what is the transfer of property that you're challenging under the transfer statute?
Your Honor, the transfer predominantly that's important here is the actual production history. And although the court is correct that the transferor of the land by lease and the equipment are non-Borson judgment entities, they're controlled by a Borson judgment debtor, Dennis Borson. And so what Helena is requesting from this court is that the court disregard the corporate formalities of those transferors as well. However, when we look at the...
But counsel, just help me on this particular point. Like, let's just accept the idea they're related, they're family members, reason to be skeptical. So I'll grant you all that for the sake of argument. But like, what's the bad thing going on if these leases are all at fair market value? I'm struggling with why that's bad. I mean, if the money somehow ends up in Dennis Borson's hands, isn't that actually good for Helena? I mean, he's a judgment debtor. Now he has more money. Well, tell me, I can't figure out what the game is that you're afraid they're playing.
Your Honor, so one thing I want to address in your question was the point about reasonably equivalent value or fair market value. And that's a point that the district court aired when it was reviewing the briefing in this case. When we turn to MCL 566.38, it explains the defenses that are available in avoidable transfer case. And the district court erred by applying reasonably equivalent value to the avenue of avoidable transfer that Helena sought. You see, the good faith and for reasonably equivalent value, the reasonably equivalent value is only a defense as to the constructive fraud avenue avoidable transfer. When there is a showing of the badges of fraud with intent to hinder, delay, and defraud.
You got 35 seconds left. In common sense terms, why is the money illegally going from one place to another, and how is it being hidden from Helena? Just common sense. What is the fraud? No.
Yes, Your Honor. The fraud is fraud by crop insurance, fraud against the federal government and crop insurance. And what it's done is it's allowed the Helena Borson entities to continue their fraud farming operation.
So why is that bad? Why is it bad that the money that they generate from the farming of the land is going to flow back through the lease and flow into a debtor hands that you can actually then try to take? If they're not allowed to farm, no money is being produced. I would think that is bad for Helena, because then there's no chance of getting anything. If they're farming, at least some money is being generated that may eventually flow back into a debtor from which you can recover.
Your Honor, I see that I'm out of time. May I address your answer or your question?
Yeah.
Thank you, Your Honor. So the reason that that's an issue and that it's not good for Helena is because when we look to ECF 148.13, starting at page 1826, you see a series of pages from meetings between the legacy Borson entities and their lender, First Farmers Bank and Trust. And what you see in there is that there was an orchestrated plan such that the unsecured creditors, such as Helena, would be unable to touch or execute upon the assets of the legacy Borson entities. Specifically,
just real quickly, are you making the point they're favoring secured creditors? Is that your point?
Your Honor, it's not just that they're favoring secured creditors. It is an orchestrated fraud to keep the secured creditors in place, but also to avoid the unsecured creditors by a fraudulent transfer of actual production history.
Okay, well that's I've got it. We'll pursue this a little more in rebuttal. Let's hear from the other side.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Vanderveen.
Thank you. To please the court, I'd like to just address a couple of points. I think you've already sort of stolen my thunder on some of these issues of what our points are, but successor liability in count one of the counterclaim is totally dependent on there being a continuity of ownership. And the record is very clear. Stacy is the sole owner and manager of her company. Nick is the sole owner and sole manager of his company.
Make of the other side's argument that paper ownership is one thing. I set aside the factual point about whether it shows anything more than paper ownership. Would Michigan law allow for you if the new entity was really being directed by a non-owner, allow for successor liability in that instance?
You know, I haven't seen a case that would allow that in a successor liability, a mere continuation, de facto merger type claim here. But the reality is there is nothing. You're right. Paper ownership it could be one thing. And that is Stacy and Nick are the owners of the new companies. They were not owners of the old companies, but there is nothing in the record to show that Dennis Borson or his folks, Arlen and Sandra Borson, are involved in the new companies.
Counsel, I mean, this to me is the key part of the case. I mean, Dennis is married to Stacy,
right?
For a very long time in Western law, married people were treated as one. Now, there were some very discriminatory components to that. It was the man who became the one, and that was quite unfair to the women. But the insight is that, you know, is it really plausible they're not talking about the farming operation? I mean, you know, they're going to bed and Stacy says to Dennis, well, we're debating whether to do soybeans or corn this year. And he says, don't talk about it. I mean, don't you think they're having those conversations? I mean, how could that not be? They're farmers. They're multi-generation farmers. And if you ask me, that is the instinct behind the whole case. What do we
do? But the reality is there is nothing in the record to show that Dennis is involved in management of these companies.
Just
might
that
they talk?
Still, just that they're still married.
They're still married. Yes. Yes. And you know, might they talk like any husband and wife talk? Might they talk like any husband or father and son talk? Sure. That's certainly within the realm of possibility. And probably does happen occasionally, but the reality is
now that you bring it up, the father son is a father myself of sons. That's even more perilous. What father can't convey his opinion about something he knows a lot about to his sons? When has that ever happened in history? They always convey their opinion. It's very annoying.
Maybe annoying to the kid, but no, reality is that though that. The buck stops at Nick. He's the one that has to make the decision on management of the company. Same with Stacy on her company. They make the decisions. They're the managers. They control the companies. And there's nothing in the record that indicates Dennis is doing anything for the companies, except maybe giving some fatherly advice or some husband advice like any family member might. But there's no case law that would indicate that that's the case. Now, even if you look at this is a little different scenario, but if you look at the Foodland Distributors case that's been cited, that's an alter ego corporate piercing case. They look at the brother and say the brother is the de facto owner. Okay, that wasn't a successor liability case, but you look at what the brother was doing there before they reached that conclusion. Brother had a company that goes broke. Okay, so that's about the same as here. But beyond that, brother causes the sister to set up a company. Brother runs the company. Brother incurs debt with the company.
Can I ask you a question? Does the record show whether Stacy and Dennis had separate bank accounts, separate wills and all of that? Or is the record silent, or did they have a shared bank account?
The record is silent on that. I don't believe there's anything in the record on that.
If it's silent, shouldn't we assume it was shared? And then shouldn't we say there's no veil to pierce?
Well, but wait a minute. We're not talking about their personal bank accounts in terms of this case. We're talking about whether New Heights Farm 1 and New Heights Farm 2 are separate entities and to be respected as separate entities, which is the starting point of Michigan law, is that you do respect those unless they prove otherwise. There's nothing in the record to show that there's any intermingling of bank accounts or other assets.
So why? Go ahead.
I was just going to add, so suppose the hypothetical that these new entities become wildly successful, garner hundreds of thousands of dollars, those profits will go to the owners, Nick and Stacy. So if it goes into Stacy's bank account, would it theoretically be possible for Helena to garnish the bank account or something at that point? Or does it, I think the concern would be that even though Dennis is not ostensibly the owner, if he's really benefiting because Stacy is paying him a whole bunch of money out of the new entity's profits, that would be something that Helena would be concerned about.
Well, just to make a friendly amendment to the question, Stacy's not giving Dennis a dime. It's just going into their joint bank account. So there's no giving. It's a joint bank account, which Dennis can use whenever he wishes.
But wait a minute, though. The money is going into the company account. There's no record that the company doesn't have its own accounts.
No, but now, the premise of Judge Murphy's question is they make a lot of money. The owner gets the money eventually. That's Stacy. And it goes into a joint banking account with Dennis. Would Helena have access to that?
If it goes into a joint account with Dennis, there's a presumption that he is entitled to half of the money. And under Michigan law, and they could do a garnishment of that bank account. They could also they could obtain an order, and you know, and I forget the exact term. It's if it's against a partnership or an LLC, it would be a charging order against his interest. But something similar to a charging order is part of the collection process. That money that's goes to him has to be paid to the creditors. There's actually one in one other case against Dennis. At this point, but regardless of that, the money is Stacy's. Now, by Michigan law, Stacy's entitled to own a company separate from Dennis. Her property is her separate property, and what she, you know, her company is a separate company from her, and the money going in to that company is that company's money. So no, that's not a basis for successor liability here. So I hope I've answered the questions on that. But
yeah, no, you're that's always a good way to think about it. Let me see if there are other questions from colleagues.
What's your answer about the fraudulent transfer of the actual production history?
Well, the first off, there is no evidence of fraud in the record before the court. And I'll get back to the discovery issue in a minute. But there is no evidence of any fraudulent activity here. And as Judge Yonker noted, fraud committed against somebody else is not a fraud committed against Helena. And so that doesn't give a right to relief. But bottom line on this transfer of the APH is that the debtor does not transfer the APH. Even the part on page 13 of the reply brief where they quote from the handbook, the federal government's handbook on the crop insurance, it says that the insurer transfers the yield rating to the new farmer. And they have certain conditions for doing that.
Has to be some approval by the owner of the land before the transfer occurs?
Well, no, it doesn't. The owner of the land leases the land to the tenant. Okay, and the tenant, you know, then applies for crop insurance. The owner of the land doesn't approve it. There's no signature requirement from the owner of the land. The tenant needs to meet the requirements for crop insurance. And then
was it the same crop insurer for both the debtor companies and for the defendants here?
It was in 2019. 2020, it was different, but that's outside the record.
Okay, so here the crop insurer already had the data from having insured the land before it was leased?
Right.
Okay, so there was no transfer really?
No, there wasn't. So, you know, and you got to understand that you've got, you know, the farm. So you got, you know, Black Acre in Allegan County that has been farmed by one entity for a period of time. The new company gets the crop rating for that farm in Allegan County. If the farmer had a farm somewhere else, it would be a rating for that farm. It's based on the farm, and then it's based on the production of the entity that's farmed it before. And the data is there at the insurance company. They make the determination. The federal regulations, as we've cited, say that the insurer determines or assigns the rating to the new farmer, not the debtor. So you can't have an avoidable transfer. The other thing that's an important point on that avoidable transfer is simply that there is no way for the creditor to monetize the APH. Let's say that we jump back to the spring of 2019 and the creditor has their judgment in place. They go out with a writ of execution. They can't seize the APH and sell it. There's no authority that's been presented to that. I've not seen anything on that. There's nothing in the regulations that allow that. Under avoidable transfer law, the SCD chemical case that we've cited Michigan Court of Appeals case, it's not a transfer of assets if there's nothing that the creditor can do with it. And that's what the case is here. The creditor can't do anything with it here.
Is it really the case you could never sell production history? In other words, some wheeler dealer that's engaged in insurance and is hedging this, hedging that, you couldn't find a way to buy someone's production history in order to buy insurance that you then transfer back to the person?
I've never seen anything to indicate that. So if the farmer stops farming, then of course the APH really doesn't do him any good anymore. It's not worth anything. If the farmer is farming, he can't sell the APH because it's got to be for his farming. And then when a new farmer takes over, if they qualify to use an APH, a yield rating from past history, they get that yield rating. If they don't, then they get this generic county rating that's some cases it's lower, some cases it's higher than the actual production history. But it's not that it's a all or nothing type thing, because crop insurance is available even without a past history. It's just you don't get the good, you know, hopefully you'd have a good rating that you will get if you have the qualifications. And that's what the insurer determines. And again, that's why it's no transfer. Now,
I take it there's nothing in the record showing a difference. There's nothing here showing what the difference is between the APH and a general county rating.
No, there isn't anything in the record on that.
So, counsel, you were going to circle back to discovery. Can I? Mm-hmm. I this is just get the question right. If the court rules that it's really not transferable, the production history, was that most of what the discovery was about that they were still seeking, or there's some aspects of the discovery they were seeking that went beyond that?
The only thing I really know of that they're seeking is the crop production history, the APH, and the discovery in this case was sort of, I would say, lacking and crazy on their part, because they've never taken the deposition of Dennis Borson. They've never taken the deposition of the crop insurance agent. They've never asked for their depositions. They've never taken the deposition of Arlen or Sandra Borson. They wait till the very last day of discovery to take the depositions of Stacy Borson and Nick Borson. And they'd never asked for those depositions before that time. And this is not just the last day of the first period of discovery, but we have a period of discovery, then it's extended. Then it's extended again after a hearing where the magistrate had a nice phrase, mush, 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 was what he told Helena, to get done on the discovery. And so this was rather, you know, lack of diligence there. The crop insurance issue was potentially, if it was an issue at first, because they had Great Lakes Grain as a defendant from the beginning with the same claims against it. And then, of course, Judge Anker ruled that the added discovery wouldn't have made a difference to him. So it's a non-issue. And that's why he denied the request for discovery.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I think we understand your position. Thank you very much, Mr. Van der Veen. Mr. Zurich, we'll hear your rebuttal. Mr. Zurich, if you wouldn't mind, just make sure I'm understanding. Was the additional discovery all about crop production history? Is that really a fair way to think about what you still wanted?
That was the next thing that Helena was going to engage in, was to obtain the representations that would have been made to Great American Insurance, which is required by the Crop Insurance Handbook. Verifiable evidence that the appellees participated, one, in the management of the transferor farming operation, and two, participated in the physical farming activities in order to authorize a transfer. So had we been able to obtain that evidence, we would have had conclusive evidence, not just a fact issue as determined by our expert longtime crop insurance director in the record. We would have had actual evidence of the fraud perpetrated by the appellees in this case.
Are these representations on a form, like a standard form, that you like check these things, that you've had the requisite management?
Yes, Your Honor. In fact,
is the standard form in the record? Or did you get that? You have that from discovery?
No, we don't, Your Honor. The standard form that's in the record, and to that point, right above the signature line states that I certify under penalty of perjury that the foregoing is true and correct. And so it's a serious issue to make misrepresentations regarding the engagement in the management and actual physical activities in the case. But one thing I want to turn the court to really briefly is that the badges of fraud in this case cannot be overlooked. And it's one point that the district court significantly erred in its opinion and order. In a footnote,
doesn't the fraud though have to be towards Helena, not towards the insurer?
Well, what I'm referring to, Your Honor, is specifically the badges of fraud and the voidable transfer statute. And here there are at least six badges of fraud that were present. One, the transfer obligation was to an insider. Two, before the transfer was made or obligation was incurred, the debtor had been sued or threatened with suit. Three, the debtor was insolvent or became insolvent shortly after the transfer was made or obligation was incurred. Four, the transfer occurred shortly before or after a substantial debt incurred. To be clear, Your Honor, the appellee entities were created less than 3 weeks after the judgment was entered against the Borson judgment entities in this case. And that's just four badges of fraud. Fifth badge of fraud, the transfer was substantially of all of the assets. Then six, the debtor transferred the essential assets of the business to a liener. And specifically here, Your Honor, this is important because—
What? So usually the voidable transfer statute means that the transfer is void. So if your claim is that the APA transfer is void, if you succeed, how does that help you? That doesn't bring any more money back to the debtors. It doesn't do anything really.
Your Honor, respect
what I'm saying, that the voidable transfer statute, okay, we take the transfer back. They get their API back. How does that help you?
Your Honor, I think that's a misunderstanding of the actual relief that's available in the voidable transfer statute at 566.37. In addition to voiding the actual transfer, the statute states that available relief includes an injunction against the transfer or any other property of the transferee. Two, an appointment of a receiver to take charge of the asset transfer or any other property of the transferee, or three, any other relief. Specifically here, and Your Honor, may I finish my answer?
Yeah.
Thank you. Your Honor, specifically here, Helena wanted for a receiver to be appointed over the Borson family enterprise. When we look at the CHS Capital case, receiver Robert O'Keefe looked at this, the Borson defendants in this case, and urged the court
You can finish your answer to the question as opposed to making a whole new argument. So wrap it up with just a few not that many dependent clauses.
Yes, Your Honor. So specifically to answer the question, it wasn't that Helena was seeking a void or seeking money from this actual production history transfer. Helena was seeking to put all of the parties into a receivership so that the transfers could be analyzed by a third party receiver and so that the fraud could stop. For these reasons.
Thank you very much, Mr. Zurek, and thank you, Mr. Vanderveen. We are grateful for your briefs and your oral arguments, above all for answering our questions, which we always appreciate. Thank you so much.
Yep.
Case will be submitted.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.